interest show. Whether we'll get through all your questions or not, I don't know, but we'll just take some of them quite quickly. Some have not been known at all so far. First one is to do with space travel. Can an animal stay in space for a period as man can? Now, who's... Dr. Elwood.
Oh, I should have thought Dr. Townsend's the expert here, but can they have done. The Russians did send up an animal, but of course in the very artificial conditions that are obtained in a spacecraft, where you get a little bit of Earth, a little bit of our atmosphere, a little bit of everything that surrounds us and put it away up, but it's very artificial.
Yes, there was the dog Laika, you probably remember, in 1957 in Sputnik 2. Since then there's been monkeys and fruit flies. And, of course, there's the inadvertent contamination of spacecraft, which is a very serious problem. Therefore, very great care is taken to eliminate microorganisms from spacecraft that are going to neighbouring planets. It wouldn't be very funny, but it has been shown that some of our microorganisms can survive on Mars. So if we happen to have contaminated it with Viking 2 or something, we go there in a few years and find microorganisms all over the place, that could lead to a very confusing situation. Oh yes, they certainly can survive in space. Were you, whoever it was, referring to indigenous organisms from the Earth, or the possibility of life in space? Or does that satisfy what we've said?
I think so. They've not come forward on that. Number two question. Did God create the void, or was God created from the void? In other words, was space always there? I think you partly answered that question when you were... Yes. But there we are.
No, if we go from what we understand now, before the universe came to being at time zero, there wasn't any emptiness either, if you can conceive. There wasn't any space. I know we can't imagine that, but there wasn't even space. That follows from the model and from relativity. There wasn't time and there wasn't space. We can imagine winding back to time zero. Well, perhaps we can't, but that's hard enough, isn't it? Can you imagine winding space back to nothing? This is a problem which has always puzzled people. If there's an end to the universe, what's beyond it? What we have to imagine here is not emptiness, but the absence of anything at all, even space. And when God created the universe, he, not being in space or time, brought the two into being so that we had a sort of framework to live in. But he doesn't need either, because he's outside time and outside space. That answers the other point. Because he's outside time, he's eternal. And if he's eternal, then of course he could never be created, because there never was any past or future. That's why in Exodus he describes himself as the great I Am.
Thank you. Would you like to add to that at all?
You can add to that.
No? Very well. Thank you. When talking, this is about personality and chemistry. When talking to biologists, they often say that personality comes from the chemistry of the genes. Can you comment on this? Personality and chemistry. Dr. Elwood.
Well, personality is a very complex sort of thing. Each of us has a personality. Our friends get to know us. They identify us, not merely by the look of our face, but by our personality. They can recognize us even in the dark when they can't see us. The way in which we respond to whatever approach they make, whatever they say, and so on. They recognize the tone of our voice, they recognize the way in which we respond, and so on. There are all sorts of complex things that make up what we call personality, and it's been an argument in medical circles for years as to how much of what we are, each of us individually, what we are as an individual, how much of that comes from our heredity and how much of it comes from our environment, how much of it comes from our genes, what has been inherited, the inherited material in our bodies, and how much of it has been a matter of training and of acclimatization and so on. And I think it has to be acknowledged that there is something of a blend here the physical characteristics of our bodies are obviously inbuilt into our genetic structure. But we inherit from not from our parents and from our families, not merely the physical structure of our bodies, but also something of the way in which our personalities develop and something of the way in which we are conditioned and the way in which we respond. I would be inclined to say there is not an absolute answer to that, simply because personality is a concept that covers or that straddles across both the spiritual and the physical.
Mm-hmm. Would you?
Well, following on what Dr. Elwes had just said, there is, of course, the very important point for Christians as to the part the Holy Spirit plays in changing our personality. And if you take the New Testament examples, there is a renewal and a transformation constantly going on in those in whom the Holy Spirit is at work. So that the answer would seem to be that while part of it comes from our genes and part of it comes from our environment, for Christians the most important contributor, if one dare put it like that, is the Holy Spirit himself.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
There's just one other point we could add to that, perhaps. In the Bible, there's a distinction made into two words for life, Zoe, which is the spiritual life, and bios, the physical life. And when John 1, in him was life, Zoe. He's the source of life. And that life which is in us, the spirit within us, I would entirely agree with what you said. There's also the idea here, I think, of you being you, if I might put it that way. Why are you conscious? Why do you have a consciousness? Why are you uniquely conscious of being you in this body? That is you, that life from God. There's no reason otherwise why you should be conscious of being you, if you follow me. If we were just a machine with certain characteristics resulting from our body, why is it that I'm conscious of being me and not you, and you are conscious of being you and not me? We have within each of us this unique thing, personality, which is of God.
Thank you, that's very helpful. Another one that's similar to this. Have any evolutionists ever tried to explain the evolution of man's spiritual awareness? The evolution of man's spiritual awareness. Dr. Elwood, have you got something to say about that?
Let somebody else respond first. I'd like to bring in a comment later.
Is it kind of...
I'm sorry?
Was it a kid?
Yeah. I haven't really studied this to any degree. C.S. Lewis, who really was a theistic evolutionist, he was a marvellous Christian man, very helpful writings, but in some of the things I've read by him, he does believe that man, having evolved at some time, had a spirit put within him. So that's not really an evolution of a spiritual awareness. Also, there's the ideas of the Roman Catholic theologian Teilhard de Chardin, who posits a sort of evolution of the spirit as well as the body. But I don't know a lot about this, and I certainly wouldn't think that it was a scriptural concept.
Can I throw in this in the creation account in Genesis 1, the word created occurs just three times, and one of those times is in relation to man, whereas in other creation, in other parts of the creation, the word is let the earth bring forth, or the Lord God formed, or this sort of thing, God formed. But in relation to man, the word is specifically created. When you go further back, God created the great whales and the first forms of living things in water and in the atmosphere. And when you go right back to the beginning of Genesis 1, God created the heavens and the earth. Now, no matter what sort of theories may be propounded of the origins of life, of man, of the universe, you're always up against it at these three points. Where did man come from, insofar as man is a spiritual being with different capacity to those of the animals? Where did life come from, as distinct from matter? And where did matter itself come from? And in those three cases, you get the word created. God created, and in this specific question, God created man in his own image. I did want just to refer to one of the insights in the Haydn music that we had over lunchtime, but after Haydn's oratorio, The Creation, describes the animal creation, and in musical terms and descriptive language describes the different animals, and very beautiful passages, then the music goes on, but all the work was not complete. There wanted, or there lacked, yet that wondrous being that grateful should God's power admire, with heart and voice his goodness praise. And I think we're left absolutely with, at the point of scriptural revelation, that man's spiritual nature, man's spiritual being, man himself, was created by the hand of God. And if we can accept the line of thinking of the oratorio, which very much reflects the language of the Psalms and the thought of the Psalms, and also of the Presbyterian Catechism, man's chief end is to glorify God and to enjoy him forever. God created man in his own image. Man understands, and man can appreciate, man can admire, and man can praise God.
Thank you. Melling?
No.
Thank you. Is there any evidence for a pre-Adamic race or races? Any races before Adam? We have a book here, Who Was Adam? I remember that one, yes. Do you want to comment, Dr. Elwood?
Well, it's a very difficult question. I do hope my colleagues will will help us out. The book I referred to does argue for a pre-Adamic race. The title of the book is Who Was Adam? And the writer takes up the theory that Adam was a specific creation, roughly equivalent to what is called Neanderthal man, and that there were earlier races before him. But because I brought this book with me, it doesn't mean that I go along with it. In the Bible, of course, there are a number of puzzling references. There is the reference in Genesis 6 to the sons of God who went in onto the daughters of men. That is paralleled with references in, or thought to be paralleled in references in mythology to the heroes. And may possibly represent fallen angels. There is the difficult question of where did Cain get his wife, and the also Cain's fear of vengeance, that if anyone catches me, they're going to kill me, taking vengeance on me because of what I've done to Abel. And so there are some of these references which some people might argue make a case for a race of men prior to Adam. Having been drawn into saying that there are these references, I think that there are more straightforward explanations of them, and I would question very much this concept, but there's room for difference of opinion here.
Thank you. Ms. Milling?
Well, I don't know whether I should say anything about this question because I actually asked it. But having read the book that Dr. Elwood has just mentioned, while I wasn't convinced by it, I was certainly impressed by it, because for those who may not be familiar with it, he suggested that Genesis 1 referred to mankind, And Genesis 2 referred to Adam as an individual, and he based his whole case on that. And that was one of the things that led me to ask the question. Because in earlier years, there were quite a number of Christians, well-known Christians, who taught quite definitely that in their view there were pre-Adamic races. And I was simply wondering if there was any new evidence had come to light to support it.
Can I perhaps just show you one or two points on this? As you probably know, amongst some of the fossil precursors, or fossil ape men, or fossil apes, whatever you want to call them, some of those famous are this one. There's also another one. I'm not putting them all down. And there's quite a large number of these. Let's spell these wretched beasts. And perhaps the most famous of all, who's been reclassified now, is Homo sapiens neanderthalis, who used to be called Neanderthal man. Now, these creatures, you know, there's a reasonable number of fossil remains for these different animals, and some people put them into an evolutionary tree. Others disagree entirely with this particular evolution tree and put the same animals onto the side. You'll see some examples of these disagreements on that sheet up there at the back. If you happen, my point, I want to really bring back to the point I said earlier, if you choose to insert on the data which you have a certain framework, you will find that framework, with the greatest respect. If you choose that there be Adamic men, then those would be Adamic men. If, on the other hand, you do not accept the existence of pre-Adamic men, then you will explain them some other way, perhaps as men who degenerated, or apes, or who weren't men at all, etc., etc. And if you look on that particular up there, you'll see that one evolutionist has reinterpreted Pithecanthropus, who was originally thought to be an ape man, as an ape who's alive today. And the reconstruction, in one case, the Pithecanthropus shows a sort of brutish man with hair, you know, quite a good hairstyle, and eyebrows and such like. And the identical skull has been used by another evolutionist to give you a completely normal-looking ape. That's right at the top of that far-left comment up there. So if you choose to see in the fossil data pre-Adamic men, you'll find them. This is my point when I kept saying, with theories that you can't test, you can't rule out one philosophy or another, whether you're a creationist or an evolutionist. What you have to say is, these are the data, and I'm quite happy with them and believing that God has created man. Personally, my personal choice on this is that I don't feel very happy about pre-Adamic men. But there are many Christians who do, either from the viewpoint of E.K. Victor Pierce, whose book I actually forgot to put on the list because it's quite an interesting book, or, of course, people following J.H. Pember, quite an early book called Earth's Earliest Ages, which he postulates a gap, that the original Earth was destroyed after Satan's fall by God and re-put together, likewise, in 6 days. He was early, one of the early ones to put this forth. That's quite a popular idea. And it's pretty watertight, because anything which doesn't fit with the rest of Genesis, you can shove up before Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. But the trouble with that sort of theory is that, really, because it's untestable, it's fine, but you can't prove it. This is my point. Therefore, I can't be dogmatic on it. I'm not over happy with it for that reason.
Don't go away, you're just in the right spot to talk about the most exciting subject of all for younger people. Please talk a little about prehistoric animals, dinosaurs, etc. What should the Christian make of the factual evidence?
Right. Well, let's say first of all that, of course, we have factual evidence. The reconstructions might be questionable, but you may be interested to know that fossil dinosaur skin even has been discovered, which again raises the question as to really whether they're as old as people think. mummified skin of dinosaurs has been discovered, and on the basis of the many fossils and skeletons we have, it's possible to make fairly good reconstructions of quite a lot of these animals. You'll see on the far side of the central exhibit a new reconstruction of Pterosaur, which originally had been constructed one way. Now they've taken the wings off the back legs and they consider, as I mentioned earlier, it's a flyer rather than a glider. So these animals existed, there's no doubt about that. We've got loads of fossil evidence for them. However, although we've got the fossil evidence, we don't really know very much about them at all when we really get down to it. In the last few years, there's been a change in opinion on dinosaurs. They were thought, and you'll see this in most school textbooks, they're rather parodied as slow, clumsy, thick creatures that, well, if you stamped on their tail, half an hour later they scratch their head and say something's hit me. The sort of thing which you see in Tony Hart, which is great fun, you know, the cartoon dinosaur. In the last few years, though, thinking about the apparent speed at which they must be able to move, and the tremendous range from the very small bird-like little dinosaurs with the long necks and the beaks, of which one, not quite like that, does exist still in New Zealand, the Tuatara, which has it's a duck-billed dinosaur, through to these mighty things like the Brontosaurus, and of course the great carnivores such as Tyrannosaurus rex. These creatures must be able to move pretty fast for a fairly long period of time, according to some theorists. Now, a cold-blooded creature can move fast for a short period of time. We've all seen lizards move like grease lightning if your shadow goes over them. But not for a long period of time. And for this reason, it's now been suggested that dinosaurs were hot-blooded and not cold-blooded at all. It's been written up, we all know all the hot-blooded dinosaurs. We're changing our opinions a lot on this, going right back to the Dimetrodon, one of them, who the Dimetrodon, I hope it's a drawing, looks a bit like this. It's best to draw it. As you can see, I only just got through over art, and that was pushing it. But he had a sail on his back. Have you seen this one? And everyone's been arguing over that. It was thought that that was a cooling vein, but now they think it might be a sexual symbol. We don't really know very much about these creatures. How can we, really? We've got very little to go on. But what we do know about them shows that they were very widespread, very successful creatures, not the slow, dumb, thick creatures which everybody's used to believe. And as a result of this, there's been quite a revolution in our approach to understanding these. Incidentally, as you probably know, some of the dinosaurs, so-called, well, I mentioned one, the Tuatara, seems to have survived. Another fossil fish, which was said to be in the same period as the dinosaur, was said to be extinct for 70 million years, has also been caught off the East African coast on several occasions, and that's the coelacanth. That is now well established as being alive, and it was being thought to be a little bit of a bit way out. I personally am very, I think the evidence is very strong of the so-called Loch Ness monster, Loch Ness creature, many of which have been observed in other lakes, including Siberia, Canada, and other parts of the world, and which photographs have been taken in Loch Ness by stroboscopic cameras, showing diamond-shaped paddles. And also, another stroboscopic photograph of this form, taken by natural history people from the States, seems to indicate to me quite clearly that the creature there could well be related to the Elasmosaurus or Plesiosaur. Elasmosaur or Plesiosaur creatures of the past. So there are some of them possibly still around, or definitely still around, more possibly. This, you may think that being a bit cranky, the BBC is so prejudiced on this, it's impossible. If you really go to the evidence, it's enormous. You want to have a look at the photographs. People like Peter Scott, he was classified his, he's so convinced of its existence. There's some very interesting photographs of this. But of course, it wouldn't really fit for this still to be around. So the Natural History Museum, which tends to be very, very, very rigid and orthodox, You've got to produce a carcass. So I don't know if that helps at all, but the fossil dinosaurs were very interesting creatures, very well adapted and extremely successful and widespread, and certainly not the parody which we normally see in popular textbooks.
Thank you very much indeed. Next question. Perhaps Dr. Owens could comment on this one. What is the creationist explanation for races with different colour skins?
Well, I think it's very much like what we heard during the afternoon, that there is adaptation, there is change within a species. All the races are still men. They're still men, broadly, men and women. But it's all the human race. In the Bible, we find after the flood that there were Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and it is generally understood that the Semitic races descended from Shem, that the black races descended from Ham, and that the European or Caucasian races descended from Japheth. But at any rate, there have been thousands of years, there have been these broad colour divisions within the human race, but it is still commonplace that men and women marry and produce children, even though they may be of different races, different ethnic origins, different colour of skin.
No, thank you. We've got quite a number of questions about chemistry and an even larger number about dates, fossils. We've just got one to clear from here. Origins. How do evolutionists explain origins? I think we touched on it this afternoon or this morning. Origins.
Yes. I think the simple answer to this is that an evolutionist or evolutionary concepts can't explain an origin in itself because it's outside the realm of that study. You can explain changes, but you can't explain the why, if that's what this questioner means here. For example, we're talking about the Big Bang. Now, the Big Bang theory is, of course, an evolutionary theory, the development of the universe since. But you can talk about how things have changed since the Big Bang, but you can't explain the origin of the Big Bang itself. That's not a scientific question. It's a religious question. You're getting immediately onto the existence of God. And similarly, although here evolutionists have sought to explain origins in terms of the primeval sea, and of course many of the basic, simple organic compounds out of which life is built can be synthesized in terms of the idea of the primeval atmosphere, but as I mentioned, that's all under review anyway now. Really, this as an explanation of origins is totally unsatisfactory. Having established that something's there, you can explain changes within it, but evolution can't explain an origin at all, in my view.
Mm-hmm. Anything to add? No. Chemistry. How easy is it to produce an amino acid and then construct a protein mm-hmm. or similar component of life?
Well, this is the problem, in fact, just enlarge it. Whoops, sorry, I turned the wrong knob, didn't I? This is a problem, if I can enlarge it just a little. I drew up one amino acid before. Okay. Amino acid. Serine. There's lots of amino acids. Here's another one. I'll draw it out in full. That one's called, for example, tyrosine. There's about 20 different amino acids that are commonly found. These are carbon atoms, these are hydrogen. That's, incidentally, what we call an aromatic ring. We've got extra electrons here, so they're not actually extra double and single bonds, we've got extra electrons here, so it's a quite different sort of bonding. These are two, this is the amino end of the amino acid, this is the carboxyl end. When we make up a protein, what happens is, just taking, say, two of these, that we get this happening. quarter is formed, the two amino acids condense together to form what we call a dipeptide chain. Now, in a protein, you have hundreds of amino acids all condensing together to form a long chain, or branched chains, consisting of these 20 odd amino acids. And the order of the amino acids can be very important. In different enzymes, you have different orders of these 10 amino acids. The reason the order is important is because certain of these amino acids, like tyrosine, which I can use as a shorthand, you can draw like this. I'm trying to imagine it slightly on this side now. Okay. This one, this particular group, causes water to be very structured near it. The result of this is that because the system, I'm using this is not a thermodynamically liked solution, if you like, so this sort of amino acid tends to go into the middle of the protein. You tend to have a chain with water-liking amino acids near the surface. Single cells such as the bacterium Escherichia coli contain one large nucleic acid molecule comprising 3 to 4 million base pairs. Those are the things that give the code of life. Arranged consecutively in a double-stranded helical structure. The gene complement of this bacterium offers some 10 to the 2 million alternatives. Now that's 10 to the 130. This is one followed by 2 million noughts. That would take me a month of writing to do. And that's one of the simplest creatures. These numbers, Sister Bernalover, are incomprehensible, even in astronomical quantities. The total number of hydrogen atoms in the observable universe is only 10 to 78. In the whole universe we've got, it's less than the number we've got there, of total hydrogen atoms. The problem of origins is, therefore, how did this occur out of such a gigantic range of possibilities? The operation of pure chance would mean that within the half billion to billion year period, the organic molecules in the primeval seas would have to undergo about 10 to the 130 trial assemblies in order to hit upon the correct sequence. The probability of such a chance occurrence leading to the formation of one of the smallest molecules is unimaginably small. But there's only one of them. How could this have happened? By chance. Do you know how many atoms there are in some of the DNA molecules that make up just one of the chromosomes, one of the DNA molecules that make up one of the chromosomes in our body? I can't remember the exact number, it's about 30 billion. We've got 23 pairs of chromosomes, each with these DNA molecules in, with the code of life on. And what a code. Look at it. I can't. Just give you some idea. This. The DNA molecule, as you probably know, is a sort of double helix. It goes like this. On and on. That's one of the helices. And then against that, forgive my drawing, I'm going to try and draw another one. Oh dear. Here's another one like that. I've not drawn it at all well. And these two are linked up like this, all the way along. You see that I'm not good at this. Sorry. They're linked up all the way along like this. I'm not doing it at all well. Across the two chains, you've got, if I try to straighten them out, okay, then you've got these two chains in the DNA molecule, and across them is linked like that, pairs of what are called nucleotide bases. I'm supposed to label them just for a minute. A always binds to B, and C always binds to D. So suppose the first one is like this. A, D, B, C, A, D, okay? Then along you have the second chain, which is determined, its code is determined by this. So this is B, that's B, that's B, that's C, that's A, that's D, that's B, that's C. You see? And you've got this going on. In the case of that very simple molecule, how many did I say it was? 1.6 billion of these. This is going on all the way along this molecule. What happens then? Because it's a double helix of this form, the property of a double helix is that if you twist it, it will separate. Clever, isn't it? So here's your DNA molecule, and a little bit of it separates like that. So you've got your two chains, and a bit of it separates when you twist it. And then what happens is, here's your little code, A, whatever it is, A, B, D, etc. Along comes what's called messenger RNA, and that goes, oh, great, C, B, B, A, C. And when it's got all that length of that particular part of the chromosome, called a gene, it shoots off. So you've now got B, you've got A, I've misread it, B, 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 A, C, or whatever it is. And along comes another large molecule called a ribosome, and something else called transfer RNA. And the ribosome goes along and reads sets of threes of these. Reads three. In sets of threes, like this. All the way along. And some of those, say BBB, I can't remember, you can look them up there, means start to make. Then it says lysine, glycine, lysine, histidine, tyrosine, stop, whatever it is. And that's how our proteins are synthesized. And these long, long chains here have this code all the way along, a little bit's untwist, and in comes the RNA, lifts off the code, off it goes, makes what it's needed. By chance. I think it takes far more faith to believe that's by chance than to believe it's the hand of a creator. I don't know what you think. I just don't see how it could possibly be that all this occurred by chance. These enormous, vast codes containing everything about us in these little tiny chains, little bits that determine the colour of your eyes, the different parts of your body, your legs, your arms, your liver, your kidneys, it's all there. B, B, A, C, D, D, do this, make, start, stop, synthesize, start. All there, the secret code of life. I can be, and I am, amazed at the brilliance and the painstaking care that scientists have put in to sorting this out. It's a terribly complicated problem, but they've done it. And to me, it just strengthens my faith again. It doesn't weaken my faith at all, because now we're confronted with an intolerably difficult problem. The early atmosphere of the Earth wasn't reduced at all. How on Earth did they even start? And even if we suppose that for millions and millions of years the lightning was flashing, it's just not on. I worked on enzymes for 3 or 4 years. I can tell you, it's a standard enzyme I worked on. If you put that in a beaker at 30 degrees centigrade, within a few hours it had denatured. That means it had changed its structure and lost its activity. Yet we're asked to believe over millions and millions of years these incredibly complex molecules, and one of them isn't any good unless it happens to be the DNA, which happens to have come together and happen to have all this codon to make this simple little link, and happens to have the ribosome present and everything else. We're tasked to believe that all this happened by chance. Never. That's why I say that I can't accept this from a scientific point of view. It doesn't seem to make sense. If you're like Boltzmann, you believe the universe is infinitely old, fine. But the fact is that even the length of time which is postulated is just not long enough. It's nowhere near long enough. As he says, it's unimaginably small, the chance that these things... But he then goes on to say, however, we're here, so it must have happened. Now that is the answer of somebody who looks at life a different way to the way I look. Because you see, ultimately, it comes down to our view of life. You can't prove or disprove. What you can do is say, as a Christian, all that I can see when I look at this is, I'm just amazed, I wonder.